The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening. And I'd like to say a little bit more about this Buddhist Spiritual Care Symposium, partly because it's just, maybe many of you aren't interested or not going to go, but it's pretty neat that it happens here, I think. A little bit of historical background is that when I was a baby in the Dharma, when I started Buddhist practice when I was about 20, and there were very few models, role models for what you could do as a serious practitioner in terms of sharing your understanding, your heart that was changed by practice with other people. And kind of the only real model that I had if I looked around was to be a Zen master. And that was a pretty lofty, you know, thing. And over the years I've seen that not a lot of people are going to be Zen masters. They're kind of a particular breed. I don't know what it is. A particular kind of people. I don't know what. It's a very kind of particular thing. But over these last now almost 40 years, there's been a diversification of roles or activities, ways in which people could take their Buddhism and bring it into the world in some way, share it with the world around them. And you don't have to be the Zen master anymore, the great, some great teacher, which isn't suited for some people. And now there's people who do, for example, the mindfulness-based stress reduction work, and that's where they take their Dharma and they do it in offering mindfulness-based activities somehow. And there's this whole class of people who have, in the last 10 years, who have discovered a great place to bring their Buddhist practice is as chaplains. And to go into hospitals where they have paid positions, to spiritual caregiving positions, to go into hospice, go into prisons and jails, and offer spiritual care to people in those settings and other settings as well. One person I know got a job at a high school, private high school. Presbyterian High School in San Francisco hired a Zen priest to be the chaplain of their high school. So she was, went in there to be chaplain. And so this is really something that's kind of happened in the last 10 years, and kind of coinciding with it's happening was that we started a program here through the Sati Center to train people, kind of introductory training in Buddhist chaplaincy, the kind of spiritual caregiving skills that are needed for that kind of role. And after doing that for 2 years, the graduates of that program organized an annual symposium of this Buddhist spiritual caregiving symposium, chaplaincy symposium. And it's the only thing like this in the country. And now it's the 7th year they're having it here. And I'm really happy that our place here can host such a thing, and people fly in from all over the country who are Buddhist chaplains or offering interested in Buddhist spiritual caregiving activities, and it's a beautiful thing that happens, and so room is filled with people who are taking that particular route in their lives. So it's kind of neat. I wanted to appreciate it with you. Okay. So what I had in mind this evening is to take you on a little meditation journey. And if you, meditation, which we're the Insight Meditation Center, meditation involves doing a particular activity, meditating, that has a number of functions. One of the functions is to help us, especially in our tradition, to see deeply. To see deeply into our experience, so the insight is important. But another function of meditation is to develop deep states of well-being that often come with becoming concentrated, getting focused, getting centered. And these two activities, seeing clearly, deeply, and being well-composed, having a sense of well-being and concentration, those two together work really well together to create, to support each other. And perhaps they shouldn't be separated out. As people meditate and become relatively proficient at it, it puts us through changes. And we sometimes it's back when I was a baby in the Dharma, we used to talk about alternate states of consciousness. You know, so this whole like, change your consciousness was a big thing. So, but there's a kind of change of consciousness, change of awareness. But the whole being, a whole way we are in the world, shifts and changes in a dramatic way as people go into the whole meditation process. And I wanted to describe the classic journey or path into deeper states of meditation that is depicted or described by the Buddha. It involves going through a series of progressions, kind of like if you think of a river going from the high up in the mountains down to the ocean, it goes through various stages as it goes down, 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 down. And at the very top, where it's kind of steep, it might go kind of fast. And it can maybe have waterfalls and all that. And then it gets down to the foothills, maybe the various streams of the different rivers come together and becomes bigger and flows stronger and maybe not quite as fast as in the steep mountains. And then as it gets down towards the ocean, it becomes much broad, perhaps, the river, and maybe now it doesn't go so fast, but now it's really stable, strong, and it's not going to be, it's just there, kind of flowing through in a nice way until it comes to the ocean. And when the water comes into the ocean, it's no longer flowing at all, but it kind of enters into the great Pacific Ocean, the great peaceful kind of expanse of ocean without it flowing anymore. And it goes through stages. So the same thing as meditation states occur, it's kind of a similar thing, and people go through deeper stages. And it might be interesting to hear about these stages because maybe you'll recognize some of them, or perhaps it gives you a sense of a direction that your practice can go. And so having some sense of the direction it goes can be helpful, because if you don't have a direction, then you'll, who knows where you'll go. So this journey, I'll begin with an analogy that I've used recently. And that is, if you make a really hard fist with your hand and hold it really tight for a long time, a number of things will happen to your hand. One is that the hand will start hurting. And it'll feel the pain, the solidity, the hardness of the hand will become quite evident. And in that hardness and the pain, you'll feel, the hand will become quite defined. The boundaries of the hand will be quite defined. And your hand, after a while, will get tired. If you then, after a while, open up your fist, release your hand from the fist, if you've done it for a long time, you'll probably feel suddenly a sense of relief, a sense of maybe the blood will flow. There's some kind of vitality will be kind of flowing. Your hand will be humming, purring. You feel very light, and it won't feel so sharp-edged anymore. It won't feel so hard anymore. It'll feel softer, and in fact, you might actually get a sense of some people say the energy or the vibration or the humming of the hand seems to almost feel like it extends beyond the edges of the hand, because it just it doesn't have this sense of hard edges as it does when things are really hard. Or a similar thing, if you go hiking with heavy boots for a whole day, and then you finally take your boots off, you probably feel, maybe because the blood rushes in freer or something, but you feel the lightness, and you feel the kind of sense of relief, and you feel really nice, and you feel like sometimes if your boots are heavy enough, kind of floating a little bit, it can feel so good. And the contrast is quite a nice feeling. So there's probably a lot of situations where in life where it's heavy, it takes a lot of work, perhaps with a lot of tension or pressure or heaviness that goes with the activity, that when we're released from the tension, the pressure, the work, there is a sense of relief, and there's a kind of a flowing of, kind of flowing of energy or vitality that tends to flow and vibrate outwards. That's very different from when things feel very tight and tense. When we carry tension in our body, it can be the same way, that the more we kind of tighten up, tighten up our shoulders or our stomach or face or different things. There can be pain, a sense of solidity, a sense of heaviness, and a sense of being very carefully, clearly bounded, like we have edges to the body, like we're solid. But as the tension in our body gets released, the body tends to feel more lighter, more open, more refreshed. There tends to be a flow of vitality and energy that's there. And the body begins feeling a little bit more porous, more open. It doesn't feel so solid as it was when, you know, shoulders are so tight and tense or something. And it feels very nice. And you can feel that release of energy, people might call it. And so the path of meditation is partly can be understood as a path of the release of stress, of tension, of pressure that we're living under. And there's a lot of different forms of stress that we live under, a lot of different kinds of tension. Some of them which is not wouldn't be conventionally called tension or stress, but as meditation gets deeper and deeper, you see that conventional, ordinary ways of living sometimes carry tension and stress in them. So, for example, the path of the Buddhist path of practice doesn't begin with meditation, but tends to begin with our behavior, our ethical behavior. And to be unethical, to be going around killing and stealing left and right, and lying and abusing your sexuality and drinking a lot or something, actually involves a lot of stress. And as a person frees themselves of the stress of engaging in a lot of unethical activity, the stress gets lightened and open, and there's a whole different sense of being, beingness, aliveness, vitality, openness, relaxation starts to happen for a person. It's very nice. Same thing with certain kind of, if you walk or live with fear, worry, anxiety, or if you live with a lot of ambition and drive and desire, it's kind of, you know, tight. The same thing happens. You get narrower and more confined, the body, the sense of self, the sense of identity, a sense of our vitality. And if you release the tension and stress of that, there's a wonderful kind of opening and lightening that can happen. And the body and the mind can feel much more at ease, and a very nice thing. And your sense of energy gets freed up. So in meditation practice, you sit down to meditate and maybe close your eyes. And the first thing you might find is it's very difficult to be in the present moment. And there's a lot of momentum sometimes in the mind to be thinking a lot. And we think about a lot of different things. The mind jumps around a lot. And that the mind jumping around, thinking about a lot of different things, the mind having a mind of its own. So we try to stay focused in the present moment, but the mind veers off into all its thoughts and concerns. In Buddhist point of view, it's a symptom of stress, certain symptom of pressure or tension that is operating. It's kind of like a spring that's wound up, and it just kind of keeps, I don't know if that's the best analogy, but things just keep moving and moving and moving. And so as we begin relaxing and settling down in meditation, that sense of the mind living under stress or under tension or pressure begins to settle. And so, and with that tends to come relaxation of the body. Or sometimes people relax their body when they meditate, and with that comes a relaxation of the mind. And these various forms of relaxation, when done well, tend to release a certain kind of energy or a certain kind of sense of vitality or openness or lightness or ease, porousness, or a sense of humming or purring, a sense of well-being. And it might be kind of slow at first, but over time, maybe over the months and years of meditating, or perhaps if you go on retreat, it happens faster, deeper and deeper states of well-being begins to occur. A lot of it because the stress is being let go of, the tension is being let go of. As we get, as this process of letting go of tension, stress, such things begins to work, our ability then to use our mind, our attention, to be focused, to say, I'm going to focus on the present moment, I'm going to be here, is no longer a fight or no longer a struggle against or with all the tendencies of the mind to wander off, not to be present. And when finally we're able to really be here in a solid way, in a clear way, and you don't feel the mind's drifting off, but you're really here, like it's like you've arrived. It's a beautiful feeling arrived. You're here, like something. I don't know. Some people say it like clicks, or they're settled, or they're composed, or they're at ease here. And there also, there's a kind of letting go or releasing of certain kind of tension or stress that the mind is we're operating under often, in order for the mind to be able to finally be at ease here and now. Let go of the tension or the pressure, the tension that gets us to kind of keep wandering off. At that point, it becomes relatively easy for the mind to stay focused in the present moment on the breathing, for example, whatever you want to kind of keep focused on. And as the mind becomes more focused on something, more concentrated, it tends to be like petting the cat, where you pet the cat and the cat begins to purr. So as you start staying focused on your breath, the breathing, as you stay focused on the object of attention, there tends to be this kind of purring or this nice, beautiful state of relaxation, of openness, of energy that gets released, that's available, that tends to move through the system. And it's what's quite remarkable is that movement of energy through our system, or the movement of vitality, or openness, or lightness, or whatever it might be, is a kind of feeling of well-being, of joy, of happiness. And it's what's remarkable is to feel joy and happiness that doesn't require anything from anything in the world to do something good for you. Most people get happy when something nice happens in their world. They get a raise, or they get a job, or they win the lottery, or they get to take some beautiful person on a date, or whatever. Something has to happen usually. But in meditation, nothing out there has to happen. Nothing has to gratify our ego. Nothing has to go along with our preferences of things we want in the world and don't want in the world. There's this upwelling of happiness. Some people describe it for no good reason. Well, it is a kind of a reason for it, and that is that the energy, the vitality of our life has been set free in a beautiful way. It hasn't been bounded or constrained by the tension, the pressure, the desires, the aversions, the fears that it's often kind of contained in. And so the sense of vitality begins happening. It's very nice. And at this point, the Buddha describes four stages of meditation that a person can go in that becomes progressively deeper as they get more and more into this releasing and freeing of its vitality. And he uses similes to describe this. So four similes. And these similes, I like these similes. They're brilliant, really effective similes for meditation practice. But they also, in that they're similes, I think it's easier for individuals to find themselves in the similes because they're analogies or kind of, they're images. And if you had a really technical definition of what happens in these stages, then I think people would try to shoehorn themselves into these technical descriptions. But a simile is kind of a little bit poetic. And so you get the idea, but all the various ways in which people can feel the deepening of practice can be somehow found in the simile. In a way you can't, maybe if you have a very technical, psychophysiological description of what is actually going on. So the first of these deeper stages, the simile is that of this is an ancient simile, so a bathman who takes powdered soap and sprinkles it with water and then kneads the soap with the water until he can make a nice, round, moist ball out of that powdered soap. So I guess in the ancient world they had powder, dry powdered soap. A modern description would be to take flour, dry flour, you put it in a bowl, and then you sprinkle it with water, and you stir it around or knead the flour until all the flour is moist, and the flour is being held together in a nice ball. So the process of kneading and working this moist flour or powder is the first description of this first stage. What's nice about this is that initially the powder or the pieces, you know, particles, they're dry and they're separate from each other. And in this analogy, the idea is that the stressed out, tense mind is often dry, brittle, and it's also often fragmented. We're going off in different directions with different thoughts and activities and concerns and feelings, and you know, it's a lot going on there. Things are not unified; they haven't come together. And it's the water is sometimes seen to be represent the sense of well-being that comes with meditation. This sense of calm and peace and ease that can happen, the subtleness, and that subtleness and ease tends to bring all the different aspects, tends to will saturate the mind, the body in a nice way, and tend to unify it together, and tend to awaken the sense of well-being and ease to some degree. But it requires effort on our part. We have to keep making the effort to stay present, to work it. We have to keep working and kneading the flour, so it requires something of us in this first stage. And the kneading of it, what this is an analogy for, is at this point in meditation, we still have to make effort to stay focused. So if we're focusing on the breath, you have to make some effort to stay there, some kind of will or determination and directedness of the mind. Stay there, stay there. That's where you want to stay. The second simile is that of a beautiful lake, peaceful, pure lake, that has no water flowing into it from the banks of the lake. There's no rivers coming into it. And there's no rain raining into it. But how the lake is being renewed is by a spring under the lake coming up from a refreshing, cool water coming up from the bottom of the lake to renew the lake, to fill it with water again. So here we have the sense of happiness and well-being that is there without any external source. No lottery that you've won, no job promotion, nothing outside that's feeding it, but it's feeding it. There's a spring from within, and there's a feeling of something within, some energy or some vitality within, which moving through the system, moving through us, that makes us feel quite happy or delighted or a strong sense of well-being. So it's an inner sense of vitality that's flowing through. So this idea is that here at this stage, we don't have to make any effort anymore. We're no longer kneading. We're no longer directing the mind. Now we're so settled, like the water in a lake, in a big lake. It's just there. It's settled. It has no water coming in, no water flowing out in the river. It's just there and settled in the basin of the lake. So we're just settled in the basin of the present moment. And we don't need to make any effort anymore to try to be present or stay focused. The mind will just, there it is, just settled, boom. And there's a kind of a thrill or a delight that can come from that. And that delight or thrill that can come from being settled but concentrated tends to feel, is characterized in the Buddhist tradition as being joy. That's often the word that's used, level of joy. And that joy comes from kind of thrill. So this energy, this inner, from the inside, this spring that's flowing through us. The next stage is that this joy settles down. So it's maybe, you know, you think that's undesirable, that you want to have joy to settle down. But the movement and the thrill or the excitement of the joy quiets down. And now the lake has no spring from the inside that's kind of moving energy through it or water through it. But now the lake is really pure and still and clear. And it's covered, it's filled with multicolored lotus flowers. That are, many of them, apparently lotus flowers can blossom underwater as well as above water. And so many of them, these lotus blossoms are surrounded and covered and saturated by the cool, refreshing water of the lake. So here are the images, image of no movement at all. The second simile had movement. This one has no movement whatsoever. So it's very still. The water is very pure and very clear, very refreshing, very peaceful. But there's something really colorful, beautiful, that's floating in it. And this more colorful, beautiful thing is not these lotus blossoms, lotus flowers, stands not for joy, but for happiness. And happiness is considered in this tradition to be more sublime, more satisfying than joy, because joy is kind of energetic and happiness is quieter and more peaceful. It's in some deeper kind of sense. And so this deeper sense of well-being is there. Some people have said that the reason why they use lotus flowers, colorful lotus flowers, for this stage, is that our complexion gets quite beautiful when we're that disconcentrated in meditation. And you can see sometimes people who are in strong meditation, actually it's like, you know, their face, they look quite a bit younger sometimes, you know, kind of a radiant feeling, you know, look at their in their face and their eyes. And here, you know, some of these lotus blossoms are under the water, and so that sense of the peaceful, cool, refreshing happiness saturates and surrounds them. And actually the Buddha said, no parts of their body is not touched by this happiness. So it kind of goes everywhere, flows everywhere. Then, in the fourth stage, the idea of water is dropped. So the first three has to do with water. The next one has to do, the image is that of a person who takes, who sits very peacefully wrapped in a clean white blanket. And for me, this is the image of maybe after you've been in the, been cleaned and purified or cleansed by a nice, you know, swim in the lake, you come out, you feel nice and fresh and relaxed and clean. Maybe some of you have been, you know, really grungy. If you've gone backpacking for a week or something, you didn't shower. And then finally you got that shower or that, you know, and you felt like you feel, you know, so good and cleansed and light and fresh. So a person who, you know, has taken that bath and comes up on the shore, sits there, and wraps themselves completely around with this very soft, clean, pure, white blanket or cloth. White is a symbol of royalty, apparently, in ancient India. It was also a symbol of leisure, because you don't wear something that's completely clean and white if you're going to do a lot of work. You know, only if you have kind of some leisure time somehow. But also it's a symbol of purity. In this stage, there's nothing left to do. You've been in the water, you've been cleansed. Now you get out of the water, and there's nothing to do. You're just at peace. You're settled. And here they say at this stage of meditation, there is no liking and disliking whatsoever. Or the mind has a tremendous equanimity. It's called the stage of equanimity, because the idea, the movements of the mind of liking and not liking, going towards what's pleasant, going away from what's unpleasant, any kind of preferences like that, that's completely settled down. That's also a kind of pressure or tension the mind's operating under to like and not like and all that. And now there's no liking and not liking of anything. The mind is just very much at ease and peaceful with however things are at, however they are. And it's quite a remarkable, almost like a revolution for the mind to experience itself being so at peace that not only does it not looking outside of itself for happiness, for well-being, for solutions for their life, but it's settled on itself and has been able to be so settled and so peaceful that it doesn't even need to operate under likes and dislikes, which is often what a mind is operating on all the time. No more likes and dislikes. How about that? And this the experience of being in this stage is said to be one of great purity. The mind is very, very pure, very clean. I mean, for our modern world, maybe clean is a better word than purity. But it feels very, very clean, open, peaceful, settled. Unperturbed, unruffled, not troubled by anything. Just there. So these are four stages of the mind getting more and more peaceful. But it's not becoming it's not a mind that's becoming more peaceful and duller and indifferent and numbing out. It's the opposite. The mind gets richer and more alive and clear as this tension and stress that normally characterizes the mind gets released or gets settled away. And it's kind of like the mind gets the essence, the essential essence of the mind functioning and operating independent of any stress at all. It's kind of like you're coming back to your birthright. It's kind of like you come back to kind of what its nature is waiting for you there. But in Buddhism, the point is not to have that kind of experience. And you're not supposed to be attached to having those kinds of experiences, like as if that experience is like what makes you a meditator. But rather, as the mind gets purified or cleansed, and we're no longer seeing things through our likes and dislikes, through our preferences, we're no longer operating from the point of view of our desires and aversions and our doubts, then we're able to see more and more deeply into how we operate, what goes on within us psychologically. And this is important because some of the deepest ways in which we hold stress, because there still can be stress or tension operating even these deep levels of meditation, but some of the deepest forms of stress are very, very hard to see. And even if we can see it, it can be very hard to have the courage or the willingness or the ability to let go of it. And to give one example, maybe the primary one, is that the attachment to self, our self-identity, to our ideas of who we are in relationship to other people, is something that our sense of self is a very deep form of stress that we carry around. And it's hard to see and understand how our sense of self is a form of stress. It's a form of it's an activity that's kind of certain pressure or tension associated with it. And because our sense of self or our self-identity is so important to us, because who are you going to be if you can't tell yourself a story about who you are? The mind is often kind of reluctant to let go of that, or at least to give it a vacation for a little while. And so sometimes you need to have, it really helps to have a deep, settled, happy, peaceful state of mind. Then it's easier to do that deep work of letting go of self-identity. But if you're in a stressful state to begin with, anxious and worried about your life, the last thing you want to be told is let go of yourself. What do you do with that? But when the mind is in this very deep, equanimous, peaceful place, it's much easier, and not only is it easier, sometimes it's obvious that it's desirable. It's obvious that this would be really cool. This would be a great thing to be able to let go of that stress as well. And that is the kind of, the real point of Buddhism is to learn to let go of some of the deepest forms of stress, of holding, of clinging, that we operate under. Not so that we can then become a couch potato, but so that we can come into the world as people who don't have stress, who can go into the world and offer what's beautiful. I mean, the purified heart, the purified mind, is a really beautiful thing. And to be able to come into the world with that makes us a gift to the world. Then we're able to operate in the world with more compassion and care. We can operate with more love and with a lot less strife, a lot less neurosis, a lot less greed and fear. Not everyone who finds great benefit from meditation will go through these four stages of practice. Or not everyone will go through them in very clear, defined ways, the way these they clearly feel like they're stages. But even in mild ways, people who do meditation for a long time tend to experience something like this. And sometimes if you can see, you can watch yourself getting a little bit calmer, more settled. And in that calmness, you can feel a little bit sense of lightness and well-being. And then you can feel that the sense of well-being kind of gets more peaceful or quieter. You feel a deeper sense of calm, peacefulness, equanimity. And you can feel that when you come out of that meditation or in it, that you're just content. You're very happy, or you're content or peaceful without feeling any need for the things you felt were so important before you were driven by. And you can say, oh, I can see that. I can see there's kind of like these, this progression that goes on in this meditation practice. It is not very strong, but I can see. As practice deepens or becomes stronger for people, the progression becomes stronger as well. And the distance one travels through those progressions becomes further and further. So, don't stay stuck on the mountain peaks. Get in the river, and you'll find yourself flowing down. And at some point, you'll find great experience, beautiful experience of peace. And what's even better is we find each other there, and we float around together. So I hope that made some sense to you, and I hope that you appreciated a little sense of the journey that the person can be on. And if you don't find yourself in that at all, then don't worry about it, because this is not the only meditation journey a person can be on. So, but it's a classic one that's taught in Buddhism or pointed to in Buddhism. So we have about 5 minutes, and if you have any questions, concerns, protests, this would be the time. Yes, Marna.
Maybe this would be for next week, but I'm not sure I've heard you speak about insight. So I'm kind of interested to know how that would happen in your four stages, where it would be and whether it would feel like an interruption. I know sometimes when I've been quiet, I'll just realize something. So I don't know if that's insight, but I'm just not sure. You've talked a lot about the insight. We're Insight Meditation Society, and
I have periodically, but I'm happy. I can do that next week.
Yeah. Thank you.
And but insight can happen at any point, and in those four stages of meditation, it can happen at any one of those points, and it can happen so clearly that it's the insight that liberates people. And it can happen in any of those. You don't have to wait to the fourth stage to have this very clear, deep insight. It can happen earlier. I'll talk probably, and then that sounds like a good topic for next week.
I can see that the equanimity and all is needed in whatever you do, whatever activity you take and so on, so you don't polarize in that. But then what's the next step into, really, there's so much need in the world. There are so many things that are not right, whatever that means, like or dislike, but anyway, that need help. Where does one go then when is established this calm, peaceful equanimity?
Well, I like to think of it this way, that if you're hungry, you go eat. If you're sleepy, you go sleep. If your neighbor needs you to take her to the doctor, you take her to the doctor. If it's election day and we need to vote for a new politician, you go and vote. If there's an earthquake in your city, then you walk out of your house and go help whatever needs to be happened. In other words, life continues around you, and we respond. And I say it that way because we respond as opposed to a big premeditated sense of obligation or need. It's more like, if you have a pebble in your shoe, it's pretty simple to stop and take the pebble out before it wears a hole in your foot. You don't have to go very far if your eyes are open to see that there's a lot of pebbles in our social foot. And so we just respond. And some people are in circumstances to respond in big ways, important ways. Some people, just it's their neighbor. And circumstances define, and individual capacities and many things define what people do. But I don't know if there needs to be any sense of obligation or premeditation exactly. I don't know if this makes sense to you.
That helps. I tend to lean towards some political activism because there's such need that needs to be on a large scale.
Right.
How to do that with the equanimity, I'd see is the key.
Yeah. So I think it's really important that there are some people who enter into the political world, it's a civic world that way, and are very actively involved. And then we have some people who go into hospitals and do hospital chaplaincy. That's what they do. So it's just diversification. We need a lot of different kinds of people. And then how to do it in a way. So one of the teachings of Buddhism, I believe, is that how we do something is as important as what we do. And sometimes people get so focused on what they're doing that they don't pay any attention to how they're doing it. And we've had lots of politicians who have been focused on the what to create peace. And they do it by creating war. And I think if you focus on the how, then it means how you are when you're doing it. Don't become someone who is full of hate or anger or contributes to strife. But do it in a how that keeps you relaxed, open, committed, so that compassion can be motivating and not the anger or the fear.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. So enjoy your meditation.